Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 4th of October 2011 here in Japan. And today I'm honored to be joined on the line from the UK by Dr. David Halpin, a retired orthopedic surgeon and one of the doctors who is leading a call for a judicial review into UK Attorney General Dominic Grieve's decision earlier this year to not hold a proper inquest into the mysterious death of Dr. David Kelly. Dr. Halpin, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
I'm pleased to join you, James.
Well, this is a very important topic, and it's one that unfortunately has not gotten a lot of press coverage. So perhaps to bring everyone up to speed with the overall topic and all of the details involved, why don't we start talking a little bit about the death of David Kelly and what got you involved and interested in this case?
Well, you know that people mostly know that he was a weapons expert. In fact, our topmost one in this country. He was a bacteriologist by learning, by expertise, and he had the highest security clearance in our system here and in the CIA, I'm told. He was alleged to have given, to have said that the government had sexed up the so-called dossier that led to the Iraq War. One of the, was the main excuse, the main pretext for it. And this happened on in the Today program in May, I think it was, of 2003. A furore exploded about 6 weeks later, much involving the BBC. And the poor man was hunted, to be frank about it. And he went out for a walk from his home, a little village in Oxfordshire, Southmoor, and 3 o'clock on the 17th of August, and his wife reported him missing to the police just before midnight on that same day, a rather extraordinary delay in itself. He was found the next day at about 9 o'clock in the morning by two lay searchers with a dog. And there's all sorts of things that one can say about this. The lady who found him sitting slumped against a tree. Those are her words. The police attended. They were already searching for him as well. Anyway, he was examined at the site by Dr. Nicholas Hunt, the forensic pathologist, and who later examined his body at the Radcliffe Infirmary that Friday evening from 9 o'clock until midnight. The extraordinary thing is, and this is one of the most, I would say, evil things about this whole business, was that Lord Falconer, who was the Lord Chancellor, he had another post as well to do with, just forget just for a moment, but the Lord Falconer had arranged that same day, whilst Kelly's body was still cooling, for an ad hoc inquiry to be set up and chaired by Lord Hutton. He agreed that day, Lord Hutton. So we have this extraordinary alacrity. And it is obvious that the intention was to contain the inquiry in the way that they wanted. And that has typified the whole process since. I can remember, I think, thinking that it was fishy, but I don't think I spent too much time thinking about it. And but I thought about it more when I heard what the Hutton inquiry had pretty well decided. They were yet to announce the formal findings, the verdict. But we learned that he had died, Dr. Kelly, from a hemorrhage due to transection, that's cutting straight across the ulnar artery in the left wrist. And he also died of taking coproximol tablets, which his wife also took for her arthritis. Anyway, after about 2 months thinking about it and not wishing to disturb the family feelings, I wrote to the Morning Star newspaper, a so-called left-wing paper. On the 15th of December, it was published. In that letter, I said that I could not accept that there would be such exsanguination, such bleeding out from this small artery of matchstick thickness, I use that term, so much bleeding out that death would ensue. I also went on to say that I found it preposterous to accept that a man of his scientific standing would choose such uncertain methods with which to kill himself. That drew me into a group then of just two doctors and a layperson who acted as liaison officer. And we've battled ever since then, James. In January 2004, we wrote letters to The Guardian. They're good letters. We pleaded with the coroner, but who were not proper persons, to use the term, for a proper inquest. There had not been a proper inquest. And we've been battling over the 8 years since then. I'm now in the position of being the sole litigant because my medical colleagues, for several reasons, mostly family reasons, could not stand the threat of costs being awarded against us. So the process is in... It's going ahead. As you've rightly said, that Mr. Grieve, the Attorney General, refused our plea put in by lawyers and very substantially grounded. He refused our plea on the 9th of June of this year. And almost at the last minute, this plea to judicially review the Attorney General's decision is now in process. So we're now waiting. I've just seen a defense document from two barristers who've been instructed by the Treasury solicitors. I haven't had time to read it fully. Came on Friday. And I'm waiting to hear from our solicitors with us, Jennifer McDermott in particular, and possibly from the QC, John Cooper. So within the next few weeks, there will be some hearing by one judge. Either he will have an oral hearing, which is less usual, where you will look at the papers and decide whether we have permission to go ahead to make a proper plea for a judicial review. I've tried my best to shorten this.
Right. Well, let's back up for a moment. And for those of us who might not be in the British political system, can you explain to us about the inquiries, about inquests, and about the difference between the two and why it's important to have a proper inquest into the death of David Cameron?
Right. Yes, it's a good question, if I might say so. An inquest is held by a coroner. It's an ancient position. It, in fact, relates to the Crown. Goes back to, I think, the 13th century. But any unnatural death in this country, in England, it's different in Scotland, any unnatural death is meant to come before a coroner. They don't always hold an inquest if they are satisfied about the attachments to the case. A coroner, if he hears evidence, will hear it under oath. And sometimes in more complex cases or cases where there is, shall we say, greater importance, a jury will be called. And in this case, in ordinary circumstances, shall we say, if it applied ordinary rules, this man's death would have been heard by a coroner in front of a jury. Now, an inquest was opened here. But the coroner, Mr. Nicholas Gardner, was instructed by my Lord Falconer to adjourn the inquest early on. In fact, it was adjourned on the 13th of August, about 3 weeks after the death of Dr. Kelly. And the inquest was subsumed, was taken within the Hutton Inquiry. The Hutton Inquiry, as I say, was ad hoc. In other words, there were no set rules. The Inquiries Act does give some guidance, I believe, but there was no oath taken. Witnesses could not be subpoenaed, and there was, I would say, an informality about the whole thing. There's another important thing, is that in the middle of August, Lord Falconer inserted Section 17A from the Coroner's Act of 1988, and this allowed greater powers to Lord Hutton and his inquiry in regard to the original inquest. It meant they had more lien, shall we say, over the essential duty of carrying out an inquest. So Gardner was very much, in fact, in the hands, I would say, of Lord Hutton in his inquiry. There weren't many other. There, 17A, as applied, has only been applied to multiple deaths. This is of importance. There was a trawler called Gaul, which went down off the North Cape of Norway, and they had two inquiries into that. They were done under Section 17A when several fishermen, sailors, were drowned. There was also a train crash, again involving multiple deaths, and the idea of 17A was to allow, when there was one common cause, there would be one inquiry focusing on all those deaths, obviously to consider efficiency and also to consider the relatives of those poor people who died.
So to be sure that I have the distinction straight, a coroner's inquest would be able to subpoena witnesses, would be able to compel them to testify under oath, and
yes.
have a jury adjudicating on the case.
If they wished, yes.
I see. So it's so it is certainly important, especially in a situation where there are details that are as suspect as those involved in Dr. David Kelly's death, which of course is politically a politically sensitive topic. So tell us about some of the documents that you've submitted in your judicial review and why you think Attorney General Dominic Grieve made an improper decision when he ruled that there should not be a coroner's inquest.
I don't know where to start, James, but might just quickly add that my wife has reminded me that I said the 17th of August for Dr. Kelly's death, to 17th of July 2003, all right? And he was found the next day on the 18th of July, all right? Some of the documents, well, some of the evidence that I've seen has not yet been revealed, and it is, to be quite frank, explosive. But it's inappropriate for that to be revealed at the moment. If I can consider just, I'll look at one thing. Dr. Allen was a toxicologist at the Hutton Inquiry. He'd examined the blood samples taken by Dr. Hunt at the post-mortem in Radcliffe Infirmary. Dr. Hunt took 5 blood samples. Only one of those was labeled as to origin. That's the first problem. You would, if you were a scientist, wish to make quite certain that the origin of each sample was labeled on the bottle. The reason being is that there are several reasons, actually, but one particular one is that if the poison's been ingested, the poison can diffuse across the stomach into the great vessels. So if you took a blood sample, say, from the aorta or from the vena cava alongside the stomach or close to the stomach, you might find high levels from that. So it's one very good reason for making sure the origin of the samples is noted. 5 blood samples. Dr. Allen at the Hutton Inquiry referred to 4 blood samples. One had flown away. He discussed the only blood sample that he described as containing the 2 components of the coproximol, that is the paracetamol, or the dextropropoxifene, which is an opiate. It's a morphine-like synthetic compound. The only sample that he described as containing these was sample NCH47. The dextropropoxifene level in that, the paracetamol level was, I think, fairly high, actually. The dextropropoxifene level was reported as being 1 microgram per 100 ml. I can't remember the exact levels now. I'm getting tired. But he said in the gentle cross-examination that the 2 papers that he knew that described death from dextropropoxifene described levels in the dead persons, but 3-fold or 4-fold higher than the level he was describing in Dr. Kelly. All right. Now, he was then asked, in fact, by the particular QC, what about other blood samples? He described the numbers, or he told the numbers of the other 3. 2 were passed by. Then he got on to NCH44. Origin, again, not stated. There was no dextropropoxifene, a coproximol, in that sample. Now tell me how you can say that Dr. Kelly died of an overdose if one of the samples we were not told it contained either of these 2 compounds. Now there was some finding. There was a finding of in the vitreous humor. They examine that. It's a rather sort of it ascends more slowly after ingestion of a poison. So there was some backup from that. But I focused just now. I'm just focusing on the blood samples and the testing, or certainly the description, is extraordinary.
It is.
That's the second cause of death. You see the coproximol.
Absolutely. A very extraordinary and very worrying that such discrepancies could be overlooked by something like they had an inquiry. And it does make you wonder about the official conclusion in that inquiry. And it I guess that raises the question of the larger significance of this case, because, of course, determining the cause of death in any situation, in any mysterious death, is important, but certainly in this case. Can you speak a little bit to why this case is particularly important and why the process itself has to be looked at somewhat skeptically?
Well, Dr. Kelly knew a great deal about what we had and what other countries had. He debriefed the Russians when their germ warfare, which was said to be a massive capability, it is said, was dismantled. He was central in that, and he was very well respected across the Atlantic, and I think in European countries. He'd advised the Israelis about how much culture material volume they require, Iran would require for the culture of certain bacteria, that sort of thing. So he was a man who was well-known, and I think he was scrupulous. And I think, from what I can gather, he was a moral man too. I would imagine that he would not, that he probably rather detested the weapons that he was having to examine. I don't know that, but I have that feeling. We are not certain what he was thinking when our country entered this illegal bombardment and invasion of a sovereign country after nearly 13 years of draconian sanctions, which had caused the premature death of thousands upon thousands of children. We have to remember all of this context. He'd been to Iraq 36 times as a member of UNSCOM. That was, I'm quite blunt about it. I'm sure UNSCOM was partly a spying exercise. The thing was stuffed, I'm told, with agents from America. And they were going around surveying most of their defenses, possibly for the later onslaught. I don't know, but that's what I could guess. So he knew a hell of a lot about Iraq. He was quite fond of the Iraqis, apparently. And something was happening during this process, this build-up, this from September 2002 until March 2003. They were engineering a war. We had this revolting dossier, which Mr. Campbell had something to do with, I understand. They were engineering that. And I don't know, but I would guess that a man of great scientific ability would have found the process. It would have grated very badly on him. And these are personal views, James. But there's a rather extraordinary story told at the Hutton Inquiry by his daughter Rachel. She sounds a good lass. She was interviewed by the court, by the inquiry, behind a screen or in another room, in another building, as was her mother, Janice Kelly. And Rachel described how in May, Dr. Kelly went to Iraq. There was some difficulty, apparently, with his visa before he left this country. I don't know where, from Heathrow or whether it's from a military airport, I don't know. Anyway, he proceeded on the flight. When he got to Kuwait, where I understand Polish troops were in charge of exit and entry, but Kuwait was the gateway into Iraq, he was arrested. His cell phone was taken from him. He was confined to a hotel overnight and sent back to Britain the next day. Now, this is our topmost biological and chemical weapons expert. A call to the Ministry of Defense would have solved it in 30 seconds. Do you understand me? It's an extraordinary story. No one seems to think it's important. I think it's important. Rachel said he was upset, and she went on to say that he was fond of the Iraqis or something like that. And then the transcript is then interrupted, and then there's a final sentence or phrase which is irrelevant to the previous words, I think. And later again, he went to Iraq. Again, it is said, there's not much evidence for that, but a man called Peter Beaumont, who is a reporter or reports to the Observer, quoted him. You may remember that they found two machines in the desert somewhere in Iraq, and this was trumped. This was, blown up, not blown up inappropriately. This was said to have been germ warfare machines, for the culture of bacteria. And Dr. Kelly, this is a quote, it wasn't a direct quotation from him, but Beaumont said that he said, "They are what the Iraqis say they are for. They are for the production of hydrogen to be put into balloons for helping to lay artillery guns." So do you understand? He said, according to Beaumont, they are what the Iraqis say they are. And that's all we know about that. And that's all we know about his visit to Iraq. But I find that quite interesting, actually, really, because his statement, it was against all the propaganda of the time. There were diagrams in the Sunday papers of these machines, aerial photographs and satellites and the rest of it. And it was interesting to me, in fact, actually, that he should be so forthright at that point. So it may be that he'd become rather uncomfortable. I don't know. But I cannot think that if I think of people in the sofa cabinet cabal of Blair, Powell, Campbell, Hoon, these people, they were a pole apart from this man Kelly, as far as I know, both in terms of knowledge, because our politicians have no knowledge. They are expert at nothing, generally speaking. Whereas Kelly was very expert in a very difficult field, and as far as I know, we know he was a family man with three daughters. We know that he was a decent man, as far as we know, and it would have been, I can imagine the meeting of minds not happening at all.
Well, indeed, I understand that a lot of our understanding of this matter and of who David Kelly was is based on in part speculation or on secondhand evidence or hearsay and is tentative because, of course, we are not in charge of an inquiry into this matter and we don't have the ability to access all of the information that a proper government inquiry would, which is exactly the point, I think, and in raising the very important questions about the official conclusion of suicide and looking at it from a medical perspective, we have a way to really examine this case and find out more about what really happened or did not happen. So I think it's extremely important. But getting back to the question of your proceedings and how they're going to go from here, I understand that if permission is granted for this judicial review, there will be a hearing in the High Court. And perhaps you can talk about the monetary expense of this and how this is being covered.
Can I quickly say, James, that if people want to read the transcript of the Hutton Inquiry, well, it was available. Oddly enough, it was taken down about 3 weeks ago and put on the Ministry of Justice. It's less accessible now, I'm told, but it was very easy. You just Googled Hutton Inquiry, up it came. And it was very adequate in terms of the records, not so adequate in terms of the evidence that was retained by the police. And if people want to read the papers that have been put in on my behalf, and with a lot of input from me, myself, if they go to the website of David Halpin, they will find the witness statement, which is about 10 pages, and a 28-page paper describing the grounds of our application for a judicial review. Now, we have a public fund running, which is called the Dr. David Kelly Inquest Fund, set up by a lovely lady called Margaret Hindle, and we've gathered about £42,000. Some people think that's very marvellous. I wish it was a lot more, because at the moment the costs are running ahead of the public fund, so they will come back on myself and my wife. We have savings, but I would like to think that there was more public support for it. The difficulty there, James, is that since we served the papers on the 8th of September, excellent legal team, and I think they're very well written, the papers, and they're very sound points, there's been no publicity. No publicity whatsoever, even though it's an unusual case, sole litigant, retired doctor, that helps a bit, Dr. Kelly, judicial review for the first time ever of the Attorney General. So you'd think that would be worth discussing in the papers. But instead, in fact, we've had wall-to-wall Miss Knox and with the poor Miss Kirker in Perugia, wall-to-wall for days, actually. And this is the nature of it, of course, you see. It's uncomfortable, this case, for some of our friends in high places. In fact, it's very uncomfortable indeed. But we'll soldier on. But if people want to support us, and I hope to God they do, if they just Google that, if they got the computer, they can in fact then get through to the fund. We've had some wonderful support and very, very inspiring messages. One from an 80-year-old man who was a soldier in the Second World War. I often think of these people, the men and women who would have sacrificed their lives or who did sacrifice their lives. He said he didn't fight for what we've had in the last government, the Labour lot, or in this present lot, who are dismantling everything around us, including our wonderful health service. And so I hope that people get the spirit. I say that our country, this country, the UK, is mired in mendacity. If anyone in the States is watching this, they would say they have it in spades. The media control the show. The media is incestuous with the governments, both here and in the States and in some of the European countries. And the only way we can fight back against this tide, black tide, is by speaking the truth. And that's what drives me, James, to do this. The other thing that drives me is it's the medical thing. I cannot accept as a surgeon this cause of death should be accepted. The pathologists say they have paid cases every few weeks of people dying from hemorrhage, from a cut on an artery. I want to see the PM reports and to know whether there was anything else, like depressant drugs, which they usually take, actually, when they're cutting their wrists. I know that because I repaired the wrists, the tendons and the nerves, when these young people had done it. So I don't accept it, and I've gone on saying that for 8 years, and it's my main motive in a way, in fact, apart from speaking the truth. I don't accept as a surgeon this can happen. Do you see? But we do need public support. If it's down to me and Sue, we will be many, many thousands of pounds down the in debt. Not in debt. It means we have to get shot of savings. And I don't think that should be the case. This is a public matter. People say, well, it's up to you helping. You're doing it. You know, you up to you. Do what you like. But the thing is, this has great public importance because we don't know how this man died. It seems likely that he was assassinated, I think. In fact, I think it's very likely. Partly because so much evidence was withheld. If it was an inquest, if it was a suicide, why did the police retain about 9 pieces of evidence or leave it out under the Freedom of Information Act? 2 policemen, including an assistant chief constable, lied. The Hutton inquiry lied, no question. You know, there's no. I can tell you the. I can tell you if you wish how they lied. I'll tell you. There was a man called Coe who was a detective constable who was the first policeman to the body. When they found the body lying out flat with the head away from the tree by a foot or two, body moved. Crucial. No coroner worth his salt would allow it to go forward without resolving it. It's just allowed, it sort of floats in midair, this fact. Coe had several people, policemen included, saw 2 other people in fatigues with Coe. Coe said, no, there's only one person with me. And he persisted in that. But last summer, in a newspaper article, he admitted that he'd lied, and there was a third person. The third person, we still don't know, he was a young person, we still don't know what his name was or what his purpose was. Chief Constable Page, who appeared, the policeman, Detective Inspector Young, who was in charge of the whole investigation, he was never called for that inquiry. But Assistant Chief Constable Page was called and gave evidence. And there was an extraordinary story of the dental records being looked for by Dr. Kelly's lady dental surgeon 2 days after his body was found. She found they were absent. And then 2 days later, or 3 days later, they reappeared. During the Hutton inquiry, Page said, he spoke about this folder, the dental records, and I cannot remember the exact words, but anyway, in essence, he said there was no evidence that they had been handled by anybody else. Under the Freedom of Information Act, there were 6 fingerprints on the packet which could not be related to the dental practice where Kelly had been treated. So it's extraordinary behavior. So you say, is it likely that this man's death was innocent in that he took his own life when so much was retained and so much effort was made by Falconer to contain the inquiry, as far as I'm concerned? And the answer is, of course, there must have been a reason for that. You must look for reasons for that silence and for those lies.
Indeed. Well, unfortunately, another case where the truth of the matter seems buried under a number of obfuscations, lies, omissions, and, yes. and distortions. So I know that the newspapers may not be covering this, but I know personally from my own coverage on my website that there is a great deal of public interest in this case, and the majority of people share your concerns. So for people who do share the concerns and are willing to put their money where their mouth is and stand up for this, I will, well, again, direct people to the Dr. David Kelly Inquest Fund at inquest for the numeral 4 drdk.co.uk, and I will put the link to that in the notes for this interview on my website. But I guess that is the overview of the case. Is there anything else you'd like to leave listeners with today?
I've spoken up for Palestine for the last 8 years, James, and I live here in this. I have a very beautiful garden here, and I have woods down below where we used to live, 15 miles away. I planted 35 acres of broadleaf woodland. And we live, I refer often to our still beautiful world. But I'm afraid it's being mauled terribly by these people. And some people are waking up. People that I know, good friends, say there's an awakening. I say, I'm sorry, I can't see it yet. And what I would like to, apart from giving us material support, which would be a tremendous boost to us, I know we're on the right track, and I know what I'm doing with the lawyers is right, and with the support of my good colleagues, a small group that we had. But what I would like to think, apart from material support, people have got to say more than, good on you, David, you know, you're very brave, or perhaps they think stupid. They have to say, what should I do? And if people do not act, it's no good just mouthing words. People have to stand up, James. You know that, like you stood up. This world is incredibly dangerous now for everybody. And people have got to get that message. It's what's easy for me here on the edge of Dartmoor, this very beautiful environment with the heather behind me, taking the dog for a walk, to think the world is going to stay just as it is. It's changing rapidly. And the people who have control of it are evil beyond words. And I speak a lot about the psychopath. Many of our leaders are psychopathic. And I say that without any reservation at all. I mean it. And particularly, I focus on our friend Blair, who's now jetting around the world talking about faith, whatever, who's meant to be performing a function to aid peace in the Middle East, and he has done nothing towards that. People have to grasp this and say, these people have had their day. We have to stand up, get together with people of like mind, decent people who want the best for their children and their grandchildren. That's why I'm acting. It's for our, I've got three lovely grandchildren, three girls. And those, I said the other day, someone said to me about, what are you leaving them? What about your money? I said, I'm not interested as much in the legacy, what money I give them, but what world I leave them. What world am I leaving them? And that's mostly why I'm acting. I cannot stick lies. I cannot stick evil. I want to see people live peacefully. I want to see a mother being able to hold her baby on her breast in peace without someone threatening them. A drone above in Somalia or Yemen or wherever, or northwest frontier in Pakistan. These things are intolerable. We should be enraged by it. I'm making myself clear, I'm sure.
Absolutely. In fact, I wholeheartedly concur with your sentiments there. And on the note of the psychopathic people in positions of power, I would once again direct my listeners to the excellent work on the subject, Political Ponderology, and also a previous episode of my podcast entitled Our Leaders Are Psychopaths. So certainly I do concur wholeheartedly with the sentiment, and I think there's something very much to that. And again, it is a question at the end of the day whether people can look themselves in the mirror and ask themselves whether they really did stand up and do something to make this world a better place and leave the ultimate legacy for our children and grandchildren. So in that case, I agree. Absolutely, not just with, we don't have to just speak with our money, but also with our actions. So some Some very inspiring words. Well, Dr. Halpin, I think we'll leave it there for now, but I certainly hope that you will be able to join us again in the future to talk about the results of your judicial review and hopefully the opening of an inquiry.
Okay, so. James. Many thanks, James. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.